It's so fascinating. Are we on 25 years for New Beginnings? Is it 25? We're close to 25? You guys should be doing a 25th anniversary coming up here soon. You should do a party for this, a big community celebration. 25 years. I mean, you realize that most churches do not get to 25 years. The average age for a church is, I'm not sure what it is, but it's far below 25 years. So I think it says something for a church to be around as long as you have. And I think we were with you when you first moved to Brickerville, and then when you were in the fire hall, and all the time that you spent over there, and all the different kind of just the people that have come through these doors. I like to say that you know, like our life is kind of like a pilgrimage. You know, like if you ever do a pilgrimage in Europe, what they do is they kind of go across. They take these pilgrimages and they stop along the way. And what they do is they call it a sojourn. They stop at a certain house that's friendly to pilgrims. And they stay there for a period of time. And some pilgrims will stay there a couple of days. Some will just kind of stop there for a moment. And then they'll kind of move on. And, you know, and then along the way, they meet these different pilgrims, other pilgrims. And they talk about, you know, their spiritual journey and what that's like. And I kind of think that that's what church is sometimes like. You know, each church is kind of a little bit like a little place where people sojourn along the way. But every church, no matter, it makes a difference, makes an impact in a person's life. And I really believe that New Beginnings has made an impact in people's lives and in this community as well. And it has really been a pleasure to be a part and to be and it's really an honor, a sweet honor to be invited here when I come here. I'm in the area, so. As Barry said, I'm a hospice chaplain right now. I've been doing that for a year and a half. For two years before that, I was served at as a hospital chaplain, and in two different hospitals there in our where we were from in Southeast Michigan. And then prior to that, I was a part-time chaplain in a senior living facility. While I was doing that part-time, I was a full-time pastor, where I served as a pastor for 11 years there, and then did a bunch of other church ministry jobs before that time. So, you know, that it's been good to be out of church ministry. I have to say that. It's been good to do that and to find a place that feels like me, which is to be chaplain. And I really enjoy doing this work. So today we're going to talk a little bit about Isaiah. We're going to be reading from Isaiah chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. While you're turning to that, I want to kind of do a little bit of an exercise with you here, but I'm gonna say the name of a year. I'm gonna give you a year in the calendar, and I want you to tell me what's the first thing you think about. All right, when I say this, all right, and I'm anticipating. What's that? No, it's in there. 1945. End of World War II. That's what usually people think about. Yeah, usually end of World War II. 1963. JFK. That's right. JFK was shot, was assassinated right around that time. All right, so now if I said to you 1973, what people would say? Well, I would say thank you. She'd say my birthday, right? That's the year I was born. 1973, some people might say Watergate right during that time, right? 1979, especially in this area. TMI, there you go, TMI. Uh-huh. 1991. There you go. See, I know, this is how it happens. We get very, very intimate with our memories. 1991, Iraq War took place. 1994. Year of OJ, right? I know. 1999, year of Y2K. Y2K, we're all freaking out about Y2K. My wife and I, we like thinking back about that because we were living in an apartment complex in California, and we were coming out over the new year out to Chicago, and we were in charge of our apartment complex before we were going, and we didn't know what was going to happen. So we grabbed a bunch of milk jugs, empty milk jugs, and we filled them up with water, 27 of them, which was for one for each of our apartment, and we put it under our dining room table, and we told all the residents, we said, if the water happens to go out, you'll find jugs of water under our dining room table. But that's how crazy that time was, right? Yeah. 2001? 9/11, right? 9/11 was right there. And then 2020? COVID. I know. Everyone was like, I know. What I find is so funny is like now you talk to people, you're like, you know, it was this and this, and then COVID happened. Everyone goes, oh, yeah, yeah. Everyone has a and then COVID happened story, right? You know? Each year, I think, is marked by some specific event or by some, like, of national significance. But some of you, as we were kind of talking about here, Luann was pointing out, but some of us have more intimate memories that are associated with those years. It's not necessarily just these national significance. It could be like a personal milestone that we had, a birth or a death that took place to us. And when we mention that moment, or we mention that year, and we think about that moment, we're like taken back, we're transported back to that time. And we feel all those feelings again. We have sensations and smells and colors. We can picture where we were in that time. Like a lot of times, I work with a lot of people that are aged, and elderly, and I'll tell them, I said, do you remember where you were in 63? Oh, yeah. I remember exactly where I was. We have a good friend of ours who said 1963, and the person, his mother came and picked him up from school to take him home early, because that's how it was, right? How everyone was terrified about that. And his mother was a little bit of an airhead, and she says, your father wants me to tell, she said to him, like, she picks him up, my friend up, and he says, your father wanted me to tell you he's been shot. So think about how that said. Oh, yeah. He's been shot. Not JFK has been shot. Your father wanted me to tell you he's been shot. And suddenly he's like, what? Dad's been shot. You know, that's how it is, you know. But that's how crazy it was, right? During that time, you just kind of get transported back to that time, and you're reminded of all the feelings that you feel. And that's why we can't dismiss the opening line to Isaiah chapter 6. You can't do this. And we're going to hear it in just a moment here. But if I don't draw attention to this, you're going to read right over this, and you're going to miss this whole point. In the first one, does someone want to read it out loud, the very first line? Yeah, go ahead, read.
In the year that King Uzziah died.
Stop. In the year that King Uzziah died. Now, Uzziah is not a household name to many of us. But just like 1963 continues to be known as the day, the year of President Kennedy's assassination, 740, 739 BC was known in the Southern Kingdom as the year that King Uzziah died. Every resident of that southern kingdom, the Judah right there, knew where they were probably, where they heard the news, when they heard the news that King Uzziah died. Everyone probably could describe the emotion they felt. They could tell you who they were talking to because it was such a profound moment in the life of southern Judah, of the southern kingdom. Uzziah had been in power since he was 16 years old. That's what scripture tells us. His father had been assassinated by conspirators, and so King Uzziah, who's also known as Azariah in 2 Kings 15, was forced to take the throne prematurely. And then sometimes a lot of times you see people who are thrust into jobs when they're really young, they tend to get overwhelmed with things, or they're so inexperienced, they're just kind of a mess, right? They crumble and they collapse beneath the expectations. But this wasn't the case with Uzziah. Uzziah was really good. Uzziah ended up being a really good king who expanded Judah's borders. He did a lot of really good things for them. On top of that, he lived righteously. He followed God's word. Uzziah also helped Judah recover from a massive earthquake, which is mentioned in the biblical books of Zechariah and Amos. But 2 Chronicles tells us something, though. It tells us that the king, King Uzziah, grew prideful, which eventually became his downfall. And for some reason, what we find is that Uzziah thinks that he has the authority to go into the temple and to offer up a sacrifice of incense, which was specifically, exclusively the job of a priest. No one was supposed to do that. And when he has done that, he's confronted by the high priest, who confronts him of that he's doing something wrong. Uzziah tries to defend himself, and what happens is God strikes him with leprosy, a dreaded skin disease that meant immediate banishment from the community. And so as Uzziah is sent away to live as a hermit for the remainder of his days, separated from society. And sadly, after battling leprosy for a decade, Uzziah dies. And this was a shame because Assyria, the great empire to the east, was making its way towards Judah, and everyone knew this. There was all this talk. No country by themselves could stand in the way of Assyria during this time. And Uzziah would have been the ideal leader to establish a coalition of nations to stand up against Assyria. But now, Judah's great hope is dead. And so when you read that opening line in Isaiah chapter 6, in the year King Uzziah died, put yourself in the sandals of the people who lived during that time. It was an anxious and it was a troubling time for everyone, in which the entire nation wrung its hands in this time of just great anguish. So, with that in mind, let's read this together. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. He was seated on the throne. His long robe filled the temple. He was highly honored. Above him were seraphs. Each of them had six wings. With two wings they covered their faces. With two wings they covered their feet. And with two wings they were flying. They were calling out to one another. They were saying, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory." The sound of their voices causes the door frame to shake. The temple was filled with smoke. "How terrible it is for me," I cried out. "I am about to be destroyed. My mouth speaks sinful word, and I live among people who speak sinful words. Now I have seen the king with his own eyes, with my own eyes. He is the Lord who rules over all." And a seraph flew over to me. He was holding a hot coal. He had used tongs to take it from the altar. And he touched my mouth with the coal. And he said, "This has touched your lips. Your guilt has been taken away. Your sin has been paid for." Then I heard the voice of the Lord. And he said, who will I send? Who will go for us?" And I said, "Here I am. Send me." In the year that King Uzziah died, Isaiah the prophet had a vision. It was not a frightful nightmare of doom and destruction. And it wasn't a vision about a great and prosperous nation of Judah or a shocking upset of the mighty enemy. It was not a vision of earthly peace or even an earthly Messiah. That comes later in Isaiah. During this time of national anxiety, what we see a person who has died, a person of power, of great power has died. Isaiah had a vision about the throne room of God. With the death of King Uzziah, I think what we see is, and the certainty of war, people were uncertain about the direction of their country. They were probably nervous. They were stressed. They were probably feeling similar to how many of us are feeling today, right? I mean, I think regardless of your political party, if we were to poll people in this county, in this room, we'd poll people in the United States, if we were to ask them, do we feel like our country is going in the right direction? I think the responses would be mixed, right? That most of us, and even the most optimistic of us, would probably still say, yeah, we feel really good about this, but oh, there's still this, right? There's still a degree of anxiety about this. Regardless about that, or what you believe here. In fact, I think we have plenty of reasons to feel anxious about the people that are the people or the systems that hold power even today, right? Some of you probably feel nervous. You feel really nervous about the prospect of a widening war in the Middle East. I know I do. I often feel that way. I have an 18 and a 15-year-old son, 15-year-old son. And every time I see war break out or war escalate or war expand, I still think about my two sons being of that age, right? We think about the leadership of the Arab countries or the conflict that never seems to end there. We get really anxious about that. I'm sure you are a little bit. Most of us are a little bit anxious. None of us feel completely comfortable with Vladimir Putin, right? Or we're not comfortable with a loose cannon like Kim Jong-un of North Korea, right? Or maybe you're a little bit nervous about any political, you're not necessarily nervous about political leader, but maybe you're nervous about systems that impact your future and the well-being of your family, right? Perhaps it's Wall Street that basically controls the growth of your retirement fund or your own investments. Maybe it's the healthcare system or the insurance industry. Maybe it's, could it be the weather patterns or the climate changes that we're noticing? Could it be business leaders who control the future of the company where you work or the economy in which you live? Same time, though, for others, I think it's the concerns are about power, far more intimate and personal. Not necessarily about those big things, those people-led things. It's about the fact that this is the year that you experience the death of a loved one, death of a friend, family member, and you feel overwhelmed. You feel really overwhelmed by the power of loneliness and of grief. This is the year that you expected, you received this unexpected diagnosis. Chronic illness, something that's terminal, something that will be with you for a long time. Or maybe you're looking at, there's a spot that showed up here. Or there's something that showed up in this kind of a test, and you're not sure exactly what that is. You feel powerless about that. And this is year you took a pay cut and you're not able to live like you used to. This is the year you were told you couldn't drive, you couldn't run, or you couldn't walk like you normally walked. And you feel less independent and you feel more powerless. Some of you have those kind of fears or those kind of anxieties about those things that seem to have power over you. Looking back on 2024, what influential people or forces died in your life? What dreams or which influenced your plans died? What people who were woven into the rhythm of your life died? What things of comfort or confidence disappeared or died this year? What limitations are keeping you from doing the things that you love to do? And what will it be like? What will it be like in this upcoming year of 2025? Because, my friend, something important to you died this past year. You all lost something or said goodbye to something. And in light of those deaths, what vision do you see? What vision do you have? Do you see something bleak and terrifying? Do you see something shining, something exciting, prosperity ahead? Is your new normal really discouraging, or are you encouraged by what is on the horizon? Well, Isaiah considered this anxiety of the time, right? And he had this vision, and what he saw was not the future of society. Isaiah dreamed about God. I want you to take a look at that, Isaiah chapter 6 again. And I want you to tell me, just say it out loud right to me, what do you notice about how God is described in this vision? What do you notice about God? Powerful, yes, absolutely powerful. Mm-hmm. Overwhelming, yeah, that's a good word of saying it, good way of saying it. Yes, overwhelming. What else? Blunt. Oh, I like that. I wouldn't have thought of that. I like that. Blunt, yes. Just comes out and says it, right? Comes out and it is. Just right in your face. Yeah. Yeah, so holy, righteous, and so much so that there's just this, you know, immediate kind of like just distance felt. Oh, woe is me. I can't. Yeah, absolutely. They also saw his own sin. Yeah, uh-huh. So he's able to kind of see himself in relief or in comparison to what God is. Yeah, to who God is, right? Yeah. I think terrifying is another thing, too. Overwhelming is a great way of saying it, but terrifying is a good way of saying it, too. Isaiah says that he sees the Lord sitting high on a lofty throne, right? He's high, lofty, above. And he writes that the robe of the robe of God fills the temple, right? Now, the size of this robe is really important to us. It's important for us to note. Every time you look at a vision in the Bible, note, do not ever dismiss details. If something stands out to you, note that and say, what is it about that detail that is being conveyed about God or about what is trying to be communicated, right? So it says, like, if we notice that the robe is filling the temple, the hem of the robe, right, the edge of the robe is filling the temple. The Ark of the Covenant was viewed as the throne or the seat of the God. Remember the Ark of the Covenant, right? That was the portable little box that the Israelites carried with them, and that eventually became the centerpiece of the temple. And when we see the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of the Covenant was placed in the Holy of Holies. So we know that when we look at this, when we're talking about that the Ark of the Covenant, there was the throne. I saw the Lord seated high on a throne. We're looking at the Holy of Holies. That's where we are. And so it's like you're all of a sudden you realize you're in a place that you don't necessarily belong. You don't go into this place very often. No one was allowed to enter this room except for the high priest. So when Isaiah says that he sees the Lord seated on a throne with this royal garment, filled the temple, it means that he realizes he's there. And there is there in that sacred place, God's presence and God's greatness was ridiculously big. We talked about overwhelming, right? Really big. Like giant, overwhelming, oversized, overstuffed, unmissable. And I remember what I said about Uzziah earlier, too. This is the other thing. Remember what we said? What was it that Isaiah got in trouble for? He goes into the temple, right? He goes into the temple, and he decides that he is going to take the place of the priest and offer up the incense himself. So what we see is that Uzziah is trying to fill the temple with his presence. Uzziah attempted to fill it with him. And so with this vision, Isaiah is reminded that it's God who fills the temple, not some average human. That humans doesn't demand our attention, our loyalty, our affection. It's not an earthly leader or a political system. We had, throughout the Christmas season for our hospice organization, I'm also our volunteer coordinator. And so we only have a few patients. We have like 25, 26 patients, but we were going to give Christmas trees to each one of them. Now, don't be too impressed, because what this Christmas tree was a dollar store Christmas tree about this yay high that was with dollar store ornaments, with a dollar store star and a dollar store plug-in lights that you would put around it. But still, it was 25 people, and so you would take some time to go to each place, and you would unfold it, and you would talk to the people as you put it up, and then you'd put it out there. Now, the response that we got from people was largely really positive. Oh, people, this were delighted by these. But their response to this was, oh, that it's so cute. It's so precious, right? It's just so little. It's, some people even called it the Charlie Brown Christmas tree, which everyone knows what that Charlie Brown Christmas tree is like, right? It's very different from the Christmas tree that my father brought home one year. I wasn't here when this happened, but apparently what he did is he brought this Christmas tree, thought it was a beautiful Christmas tree, brought it home, and he could hardly fit it in the door. And when he brought it in, it overwhelmed the entire living room. And my dad says that he was mocked by my mother and by my brother, who just looked at it like, what were you thinking that you could bring such this massive tree in there? It was not unlike the Christmas tree that we see in Christmas Vacation. Remember when Clark brings home the big tree and he has it all tied together and he cuts the rope and the branches, you know, fly open and break windows and lamps and all that kind of stuff. That was kind of like what this tree was. The image that we get about Isaiah's vision about God is not of this cute little presence. That's Uzziah. Instead, what we get is more like the massive tree that is brought in and fills the entire room, probably with its scent, its presence, dominates the attention of everyone.
And that's what that's the idea we got. God is the one that fills, that has the power and the ability to fill the space, not some cute representation of it, a cute dollar store representation. And in addition, what we see is that Isaiah sees what the text refers to as seraphs, heavenly beings, bizarre heavenly beings, right? They've got wings on their feet, wings that cover their eyes, right? And then wings that they use to fly, right? And these are, in essence, they're covering these, when they cover themselves, they're covering their nakedness, every part of their body, because they are in the presence of God the Almighty. And these beings are calling out to one another, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. And then there's this earthquake, right? And smoke. Remember what Uzziah helped the people of Israel get through? People of Judah get through? He helped them recover from an earthquake. People knew what the earthquake was all about. It was a terrifying, brings back powerful memories for them. It would have shaken people to the very core. And Isaiah, though, he's not like a seraph. He doesn't have wings to cover his nakedness. And so he feels exposed and he feels ashamed. How many times have you had this dream, right? You've had dreams where you're like maybe standing in the Oval Office or you're walking down the red carpet at the Oscars and you realize suddenly that you're naked in these dreams, right? Or you realize that you're only wearing your pajamas, or you're given this big public presentation or something like that, and you realize, oh my gosh, I'm like, it's a terrible nightmare that you have, right? I've had it many times before, where suddenly you feel exposed. Or maybe it's something like along the lines like what happened the other day where I was, when I went to a dermatologist, because I needed to have my dermatologist check out various different spots on me. Have you ever done this before? Where you've done this? It's a terrible experience. They ask you basically, they don't ask you, they tell you, strip completely down, and you stand there completely in your, you know, with nothing else on, and there is in this case, the doctor is looking me up and down and checking every spot. And then there is a young woman sitting there with a pad of paper marking down every spot that he would actually point out. I'm telling you, I have rarely felt so vulnerable, so exposed in all of my life. And part of it, too, is like if you look at my head, I've got them everywhere. I've got spots all over me. And that's how probably Isaiah felt in this moment. He felt like he was completely exposed, and every spot in his life was available and was exposed to God at that point. And so it's no wonder why he says, and one of your probably your translation says, "Woe is me!" Right? Oh my gosh! How unlucky am I? How cursed am I? You know why? Because my mouth speaks sinful words, and I live among people who speak sinful words. Notice, Isaiah doesn't try to distance himself from society. This is what we have a tendency to do. We have a tendency to say, well, I don't say things as bad as they do, or I don't do things as bad as they do. They started it. They did it first. Or sometimes what we say things is we're like, you know what I just said right there isn't really a reflection of me. No, that's not true either, right? It is a reflection of us. So what happens is this seraph grabs a set of tongs after Isaiah recognizes his sinfulness, and he grabs a coal and he hovers over Isaiah, and he within those pinchers that right there is that red hot coal, and it purges his lips. And he touches it there, purges that lips, and he says, and Isaiah hears God ask a question to all the world, who will I send? Who will speak for me? And Isaiah hears his own voice say, here am I, or here I am, send me. That is the vision Isaiah has in the year that King Uzziah died. During this time of great anxiety and uncertainty, Isaiah sees a vision of God's glory. Isaiah comes to grip with who he is. He confesses what he's done. He receives God's transforming power. And he answers the call to be sent out as God's prophet. That's Isaiah's vision. And so what's yours? Isaiah's vision is Isaiah's vision. It's not your vision. It is instructive to us. It teaches us, Isaiah's vision does. But each one of you is being called in your own way. Each one of you has a vision or can have a vision if you will open yourselves to that. If you will say, Lord, I just want you just that I am open. I need to know. I want you to tell me what it is that you want me to see this year. Is it an anxious, will it be an anxious dream about your country or a triumphant dream about our nation's glorious future? Or is it a vision that prioritizes the greatness of God? The greatness of God in your own life. During this emotional year when I think our country has expressed a wide range of feelings, I think it's important for all of us to take a moment and take in the glory of God. Not the power of people or political systems or the strength of a nation. Not the stability of our wealth or the warmth of our homes. Not the fitness of our bodies or the glory that fills this, or the glory that just that we seem to be dazzled by in front of us. Let's take a moment to take in the power of God whose glory fills the world. We make so many cute little attempts, I think, to fill the space of our lives with just these little things that kind of just draw our attention to them. We devote a great deal of energy to efforts to diminish our fears and to instill confidence in us, but they can't do what God does. God has the power to bring peace. God has the power to change hearts. God has the power to touch people at a soul level. God has the power to begin movements. God has the power to heal. This is God's glory. And every place that God that we see peace, every place that we see compassion, every place that we see righteousness at work, every time we see encouraging words spoken, that is God's glory. That is God's glory. When we see generosity, when we see joy, God's glory is found there. So today, stand in God's glory. Don't spend one more minute wringing your hands or dreaming about what your political figures will do or will not do. Instead, get lost in the wonder of God and let your focus be fixed on the power of God, who alone has the power to do all those things. If you've been despairing over the vision of a country that is ruined, consider God's glory, that it's the power to change the course of human history. And if you've been grinning ear to ear, dreaming of national prosperity and how your party will be in control of the branches of government, step back, stand before God, and see our human efforts in light of God's power, who can remove earthly leaders and also establish them. And when you do this, when you stand in awe of God and how God's glory and how God is at work all around you, you're going to be humbled. You will realize who you are, what you have done. Isaiah realized this when he was a man of unclean lips, right? In other words, he had sinned. He had said things that he should not have said. Said hurtful things. We don't know what he said, but he did. And so he confessed to God. I think there's been a lot written lately about the role of shame in people's lives and how people say, look, there's this idea of that shame causes us to live, causes us to basically think that we're not worthy of love, we're not worthy of respect, or we diminish ourselves, we put ourselves down. And so there's been a lot written, a lot spoken lately about how we need to get away from shame and how shame is this toxic force in our life. There's an educator named Carla McLaren who writes in her book, The Language of Emotions. She talks about how shame really is this, and I'll just say it this way. I'll say it's God-given because she comes at it from a secular perspective, but I'll say it's a God-given feeling or emotion that we are given that basically helps us see that we have fallen short of a personal standard. The Christian way of saying it is that we have fallen short of the glory of God, right? That's what it says. And so what happens is that what McLaren says is that shame becomes toxic when we allow it to diminish ourselves, when we say, I am not worthy of love, and I am not worthy of respect, and we just completely beat ourselves down. But shame here in Isaiah does not do that. He recognizes that he's fallen short. He recognizes that he's sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And he says, woe is me. And then he receives the purifying presence of God and he repents. The coal purifies him and says, you are now ready to you're not supposed to be wallowing. I'm looking for someone to be sent. I remember I tell my family this. When I was in college, I used to go to a barber, and it was one of those, like a barber that had one chair down at the bottom level of his house, and he had a big picture window in front. And I'd go into this place. I'd go in there during my breaks in college, and he'd be sitting there in his big barber chair. He'd be waiting for me, and he'd get up without a word, and he would sit down, and he'd bring that big blanket, tarp, I don't know what to call it, but it was like cape, thank you, the cape, swing it around, tie it around me, and then he would kind of massage my head, and then he would take a clipper, and then he had such a clean stroke, and then he would take this warm shaving cream, and he would put it all on my back of my neck, and then he would take a straight razor, and he'd go, wow. And he would just go right along the back. And then he would take this blue antiseptic, and after he would kind of put it, and he would put it right on the back of my neck, and it would just sting slightly, but not too much. And then he would take he would take a hand massager, and he'd put it on his hand, and it would vibrate his hand. And then he would rub my shoulders and my back, and all go down here all the way across. And then he would turn it off, and then he would untie, and then he goes, there you go, all fixed up. That would be it. And I'd pay him $8, including the tip. And I'd be out the door, and that would be it. And I always remember what a wonderful experience that was. But the line that always stood out to me is, there you go, all fixed up. And I always think, when I was reading this passage, after he had had that coal just put to his lips, in my mind, I heard my barber say to me, there you go, all fixed up. Now you're ready to go. Who will I send? Who will I send? You, the one I've just fixed up right now. When we confess to God, it is not a wallowing, beat ourselves down. It is the beginning of restoration so that we can do the work of God in the world. That's what it's all about. And anything other than that is a lie, that we're buying into something else. Satan has a tendency to convince us that if we confess, that we will have to wallow in grief and self-pity. And so we keep ourselves from experiencing the glorious first step that comes from restoration, and that is confession. Sometimes in our church, we will say what's called the Great Confession, which is a prayer found in the Book of Common Prayer. And there's this one line that just always gets me. It always makes me all want to cry every time I say it. He says, we confess that we have sinned again in thought, word, and deed by what we have done and by what we have left undone. It always hits me really hard. Because it's not necessarily about just the things that we have said or done. It's the times that we've chosen to be silent, the things that we've chosen to not do. And so I'm always reminding myself when I'm taking my walks in the morning, I'll say in my time of confession to God, I'll say, God, I confess that I have not loved my neighbor as myself. I have not loved you with my whole heart. I confess that I have sinned against you in thought, word, and deed. All those things I'm confessing. And I realize, I've learned to recognize that is the beginning of redemption. So let's stand before God. Let God take the coal. Let him burn our lips. We can't change what we said in the past, but God can change us for the future. We can't change what our lips have said, but God can purify us and make us right so that we can do God's work in the world. The call of God is not necessarily to say nice, encouraging thing, because that's not what Isaiah is called to do. Isaiah is actually called to be a prophet. And if you continue reading in chapter 6,
The call that he's asked, the things that he's asked to do, is not fun. It's not good. In fact, he tells him, I want you to talk to people so that they're confused, so that they don't hear. So what the people, so Isaiah finds is, yeah, I'm being asked to do a terrible thing. He's not asked to be doing something great and glorious. Isaiah was being asked to actually do a dirty part of God's plan. Isaiah was being called to a mission that would not yield results in his lifetime. And yet, this was part of God's plan to redeem and to save his people. My friends, God is calling each of us to speak the truth of God's word with purified lips. And let me assure you, the fruit of your effort will probably not be seen in your lifetime. You will be asked to say things that are not popular, that are not well-liked, that are considered maybe even offensive. And so, in this year that you fill in the blank, where is God? How big is God in the present, in your present and in your future? And how is God present in your dreams, in your visions for the future? As I was preparing for this, I sat out in the lobby of one of the, where Barry and Colleen live, right near their restaurant there, Hearth and Harrow. And I would sometimes go and just to kind of take a break from preparing for the sermon, and I would go take a little bit of a walk, and I was trying to find a way to kind of wrap these things up, that wrap the sermon up. And I walk next to the bulletin board, and I see a little sign there that says, "Dream Big." And I walked past that several times before I finally stopped and I said, oh, there it is. Dream big. And I was talking to my, yesterday during our family gathering, we were talking to all of our nephews and nieces. And I was so excited by some of their big dreams. And I envied their life, their place where they were in life, right? That they were young and they could just dream really big. And at the same time, I recognize that it's not necessarily about dreaming big for our lives. Then we mess it all up. It's about dreaming in a very big God who is going to be there whatever decisions we make. If we answer the call to God's life on our own life, that God is going to be there. And there, and there. God is big. So we dream big, not in our own dreams. We dream of a very big God who will be there as we answer that call. Would you pray with me? Loving God, we thank you for this time that we've had together today. I'm so grateful for my brothers and sisters in this room who have chosen to sit here and to read your word and to sing. Lord, I pray that you would, I pray that something was said, something was sung, something was spoken today that would burrow into their minds and would not let go. I pray that it would be transformative to them. I pray that as they consider the year 2024 and consider maybe what year this was to them, I pray, God, that they would not feel hopeless. I pray that they would not be lured by cute representations of you or small little political or celebrity leaders. I pray, God, I pray that you would instead open us wide, to your big and glorious self, to your Son Jesus, who died for us to set us free, who came to this world in such a small little package, and yet reminds us of how big and tremendously awesome you are. God, as you abide with us this week, as we listen to your voice, as we watch for your vision in our own lives, oh God,
Oh God, fill us with your courage so that we can answer your call. Here we are. Here I am. Send me. Amen. Thank you all. Let me be here. Yeah.